many of us know the name Richard Gombrich and not met the man. He's the Bowdoin Professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University and Professorial Fellow of Balliol College since 1976. And he's also the president of the Pali Text Society. He's written numerous articles and books on Buddhism, two of which are How Buddhism Began, which many of us probably know more than the others, and Buddhist Precept and Practice. So it's a great privilege to have him here this evening. And the title of his talk is Can We Know What the Buddha Taught?
Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I think Buddhist summer school, which I've never attended in its entirety, must be rather confusing in its eclecticism. What is it that holds Buddhism together? Well, one thing is, I suppose, that Buddhism is the religion of the middle way. And on the one hand, you, as the Buddha said in his first sermon, you have what was called in Pali Kama Sukhalika Anuyogo, that is, you have a big dinner with many courses and many wines, and afterwards the after-dinner speech. And then there is what he said was equally undesirable, the Atthakilamata Anuyogo, the ascetic way, where you have no dinner, so you don't have any speeches afterwards either. And the Buddhist summer school is the middle way, where you have a decent and moderate dinner, and then you have to have a lecture. So I hope to be in the middle way. Now, can we know what the Buddha taught? First, a very brief answer. Yes, more than you might think. Then I retreat from that answer to approach the subject rather obliquely, and I will come back to justify my answer gradually. But I'd like first to pose a sort of prior question. Does it matter? Why should we want to know what the Buddha actually taught and said? After all, the Buddha famously exhorted us to make up our own minds about things, though I think that is somewhat misrepresented often, because he did go on to say that if you do this carefully, you will come to the conclusions that I have come to. If you read the Kalama Sutta carefully, that is what is in fact being said. However, I return to the point I began with, diversity. One of the reasons I think why it's very interesting to ask the question about whether we know what the Buddha taught and how do we know and so on, is that, I mean, if we are really honest, the more we learn about what Buddhists have written, thought, practiced, and so on, the more amazing the diversity does become. And it is really not all that easy to see any coherence in it, if you take it as a phenomenon of world civilization, or indeed to see a single thread running through it. The single thread running through it is really the sort of thread that a historian can trace. As I tried to show in my book, How Buddhism Began, which is subtitled The Conditioned Genesis of the Early Teachings, that even if you can't find a complete homogeneity, a complete coherence, what you can perhaps do is show how one thing led to another, because Buddhism is, after all, very much about causation and about how one thing leads to another. You can trace lines of historical development. I want to begin in a way, therefore, by suggesting to you that the history of Buddhism, a sadly understudied subject for obvious practical reasons, such as that you need to know languages, the history of Buddhism does have a great interest for anybody who is interested in the development of important ideas and of human progress in ethical and indeed in some intellectual matters. Because if we can get a sort of very good idea of what was there at the beginning, we may be able, we're still very, very far from having attained this goal, but that's mainly because so little work has been done. We may be able to show how one thing led to another in this direction and that. For instance, to take a very important but very simple example in a sense, if the Buddha never clearly stated either that there exists a world outside your mind or that there does not exist a world outside your mind, if he never clearly said either of those two things, but made various statements which could be interpreted in either way, if taken out of context or misunderstood or whatever, but anyway, the statements are there in texts, it becomes rather easier to understand why, for instance, the Theravadin Abhidhamma came to the, made it a point of, a fundamental point of their doctrine that the external world is real, and the Yogacara, school of Mahayana philosophy, came to the opposite conclusion. If there's an initial ambiguity, or something which is perceived as an ambiguity, not perhaps that, in fact, I do not believe myself that the Buddha didn't know the answer or have a position on this question. The trouble was that his position was rather a subtle one, and his position being that there is nothing but experience to go on, and whether there is something really out there or not, in the nature of things, is ultimately unknowable and irrelevant to salvation. But if he takes that rather subtle position, it can lead in either direction. I just bring that in, although it's a very important matter. In my talk, it plays a minor part. It's simply there as an illustration to show you that to understand the position taken by the Buddha may enable us to trace the lines of development, which of course very soon came to diverge. Now, not that the development of the history of Buddhism is not only due to internal attempts at interpretation of the Buddha, misunderstandings, arguments, and so forth. There are, of course, also external influences. You certainly won't get very far in understanding the history of Buddhism for its first 1,000 years in India unless you take account of Brahminism, a point which I shall heavily return to soon. That Brahminism played the leading part in the civilization of cultured people in India and heavily influenced Buddhism. An example just came up over dinner, as it happens, that of course the ancient position of anti-Brahmin or non-Brahmin ascetic religions was that it didn't matter what you ate because you weren't supposed even to notice what you ate. And Brahmins, on the other hand, had strong views about food taboos and what you could and could not eat to, in order to lead a pure life. And these ideas from the Brahmins very soon came to influence Buddhists, so that by the time, the 2nd century AD, that Buddhism moved to China, Buddhists themselves were already claiming to be vegetarians, and presumably mostly were vegetarians, because that was what was culturally prestigious, something imposed by Brahminism. Obviously then, when Buddhism gets to China, a whole new set of influences comes in. So to trace the history of Buddhism, we need to be able to do two things. One is to follow the history of Buddhist ideas and customs within Buddhism and say what they picked up, what they misunderstood, and so forth, but also to show how external influences played upon them. And surely you won't understand Chinese Buddhism without knowing something about the cultural background of China before Buddhism got there, similarly with Tibetan Buddhism and so on. Therefore, the whole thing is a huge enterprise, and something that, if the university survive, perhaps we'll still be doing in a couple of centuries. So I'm a little pessimistic about that. But the starting point is certainly going to be having a look at the Buddha himself. Now, what is the evidence for that? This is an after-dinner talk. I mustn't go into very lengthy and boring detail about what the evidence for what the Buddha taught is, but we can take it that we can accept that there is a large body of scripture, the Tripitaka, and in particular the body of sermons, the sutras, in that Tripitaka, and some of the Vinaya rules, which there is very good reason to think are extremely ancient, much more ancient than the other material, and which, of course, survive in Buddhist tradition accompanied by commentaries. Now, in a Theravada country, for instance, they got things sorted out in a nice, simple way. There were lots of texts, there were lots of commentaries. But the commentaries were sort of edited, rewritten perhaps, and so on, around 400 AD by somebody called Buddhaghosa, who not merely wrote commentaries on the main bodies of scripture, but also wrote a very large compendium called The Path to Purity, Visuddhimagga, which is a masterpiece. It's very, very, very densely written, but not unclear, and it is a completely coherent account. I'm not aware that the Visuddhimagga has any internal contradictions at all. A completely coherent account of what he considered the teachings of the Buddha to be. When you read that wonderful book, What the Buddha Taught by the Venerable Walpola Rahula, you are getting a distillation of the Visuddhimagga, of what Buddha was, with a few sort of wise remarks of the Venerable Rahula thrown in to season it. And that is what Theravada Buddhism is today, more or less in all the Buddhist Theravada Buddhist countries. It needs awkward people, people with questioning minds, the sort of people who used to be welcomed in universities, certainly no longer are, to come and look at things a little more closely and say, well, is it really all like that? Is it so simple? You don't actually need to go very far when you read the Pali texts to discover that not merely is it not as all exactly the way it's laid down by Buddhaghosa, but there are very, very puzzling discrepancies, incoherences, inconsistencies, and so on. And then you turn to two other sources. You turn firstly to the commentaries that I've already mentioned, and so what do the commentators have to say about them? And with any luck, and not very often in luck, the commentary will say something and it will sort of twist the words and so on, saying, well, although he says that there are six so-and-so, he really means that there are five because that's what it says somewhere else, and the sixth is actually the same as the fifth or something, although you can see for yourself that it isn't, but the commentary says that for you and sort of lays your doubts to rest. It doesn't very often happen like that. You can turn, of course, to the other version which survives of most of these texts, the version which survives in Chinese, a translation which was made, most of these texts were translated around 400 AD, which is 8 centuries or so after the Buddha's death. It's a long time. But anyway, you can look at the Chinese version, and when you have a real difficulty, I have had the privilege, I may say, of often having in my classes over the last 30 years people from Taiwan, Japan, Korea, and so on, who did know Chinese, and I've often had them sit in on these classes, and I've looked forward to these events with great enjoyment, because I've read this text, there's a problem here which I can't see, the Pali doesn't seem to make sense, and I say, what does the Chinese version say? And there's a long pause, and they've worried frown, and they look backwards and forwards, and backwards and forwards, they say, it's left out. 98% of the time, I promise you. So, at least you know you've spotted the problem right, because that's the bit they've left out. It's a kind of reassurance, though not a very welcome reassurance. Now, I just want to be to illustrate for you. I won't apologize for, as it were, you, loading you with a few Pali words, not technical terms or anything, but a few Pali words, because really you can't do any of this research without knowing some the Pali words. The translations are usually are wrong or just don't notice these things. But there is a little passage of text which occurs in five times in the suttas of the Pali Nikayas. It occurs, for instance, in the Chakravarti Sihanada Sutta of the Digha Nikaya. And this little paragraph characterizes some group of holy men whom you should respect, and indeed whose opinion you should go and ask when you, if you're puzzled about religious matters. And it says of these little of this group of holy men, unspecified, you see, that it's called Samana Brahmana, in other words, Brahmins or non-Brahmin holy men. It says a few other things about them, that they are very sort of patient and gentle and mild and so on. And then it has a very odd phrase. It says, Ekam attanang daminti, ekam attanang saminti, ekam attanang parinibba penti. Now, the word eka is the ordinary Sanskrit or Pali word for one. And like one in many languages, it can also mean lone or alone or something like that. But the one whiskey I like is Suntory, or I like Suntory whiskey alone, it comes to the same thing. So it means one, lone, or alone. And atta is the Pali, your bugbear, taboo in here, the self, right? Or the soul, or whatever. The atta is the Pali for the Atman. And then these are three verbs. And it says of this group of holy men whom you should respect and whom you should ask your problems, that they tame what looks like the one self. They pacify or calm the one self. They bring to nirvana the one self. Or they tame one self. Let's not say, there's no the in Pali. So they tame oneself, they pacify oneself, they bring to nirvana oneself, that would give them three selves, perhaps. Or if it's the oneself, that would give them one self. But then three or one, surely they shouldn't be having any. And how can you bring a self to nirvana? That is really rather puzzling. Well, I published a little article which I was sure nobody would have read, so I thought I could use it this evening. I bet I'm right, too. A few years ago, about this passage, which has occurred, which, as I say, occurs in five suttas. And I show that the commentators, faced with this, resort to desperate measures to try and explain what it's about. But although all these commentaries are supposed to be by Buddha Ghosa, by the same person, he was only an editor, and he had off days, and he worked long nights, and so on. And actually, all the five commentaries explain it differently, which is very... And none of them actually can understand what it's about at all. So they resort to five different desperate measures, which I needn't bore you with, to explain what it's about. Well, what is... Now, this immediately knocks on the head the idea that the commentaries really are homogeneous. They aren't. There are lots and lots of discrepancies in the commentaries. But what about the much more important for us, what about the sutras themselves? What are they doing? What is being said? Well, there is one text which is rather different, where the context, you get exactly this set of words, these nine words in this order, but the context is not that there's a nice group of holy men whom you should go and visit and so on. The context is quite different. The context is, like as in many Buddhist suttas, that a Brahmin comes to the Buddha in a rather hostile mood and attacks him. And he attacks him and says, look, we Brahmins, we perform sacrifices which are for the common good, for the good of everybody, and we benefit lots of people by what we do professionally as holy men. What about you, the Buddha? You do this sort of meditating and so on, but you Buddhists, all that you do is that you train, or you calm, you discipline yourself alone, each of you. You calm yourself alone. You bring to nirvana yourself alone. You aren't doing anything for anybody else. You're just being selfish. This is the famous criticism which centuries later was picked up by certain Mahayana texts and made against early Buddhism, that by practicing to become an arhat, you're only benefiting yourself alone. That criticism is simply in a sutta, in the Anguttara Nikaya, put in the mouth of a Brahmin, and then is refuted by the Buddha, who explains how, on the contrary, by preaching this way, he fits countless millions of people. So it makes sense originally, but this set of words has been taken, transplanted from this text where it made a lot of sense, it made very good sense indeed, and put in a context where it's made no sense. And yet people have happily gone on for 2,500 years or so transmitting this and not particularly worrying about it. So, my job is to worry. Now, 45 minutes you want? Yes.
Well, it's about 9 o'clock.
Yeah, but you want questions first. Right. Now, then, so how can we know what the Buddha taught? This is the question. Firstly, a very Buddhist answer, I submit, by using our minds, by being critical of the tradition and thinking that, well, those texts must have started somewhere. It's very unlikely that they started with a committee, because no committee has ever produced a good idea, let alone a joke. And the Buddhist texts are full of jokes. They must have started with a very great mind indeed, a genius. Do we know what he taught? Well, there was no literacy in India at the time. There was an oral tradition. The Brahmins had shown the way with their recitation of the Vedas of how to preserve a text orally. They had it all organized, though not in any centralized institutions, but in family traditions, where young males were expected to sit down and under the guidance of a teacher, often an uncle or a father or a grandfather, recite these texts, and they spend many years doing so. And when Mahavira, the founder of Jainism, who was a contemporary of the Buddha's, died, it's reported in one of the suttas that his disciples immediately started quarreling over what his teachings had been, because some had heard one thing on some occasion, some had heard another, and so on. It's quite natural. This is in one of the Buddhist suttas in the Digha Nikaya. And the Buddha said, well, mind you get my teachings clear so that this doesn't happen to my following when I die. They must have started formulating texts in a way, even while as texts, that is, as items to be recited and learnt by heart and passed on from teacher to pupil, even during the Buddha's lifetime. There's a very important set of poems called the Attakavagga in the Sutta Nipata, and it's recorded in the Vinaya that one day a young monk came to see the Buddha, and the Buddha asked him to recite the Attakavagga to him and then praised his performance. Now, of course, we cannot know that he recited exactly the text of the Attakavagga that has come down to us. That's impossible to know. But it's a good guess that it's got a lot of similarity. After all, we have this set of poems called this, and the very fact that they're full of difficulties is some sort of guarantee. It's a principle of textual criticism, actually, that if a difficult reading is preserved, it's likely to be authentic. So there were these texts. Of course, the Buddhist tradition has simplified this and said that after the Buddha's death, 3 months after his death, those of his followers who were enlightened monks, only males we notice, gathered together and recited his text under certain organized circumstances. Something like that could indeed have occurred, although there's a problem with the tradition because every Buddhist sect actually has all the details different. But still, something like that may well have occurred. I won't go further now into the reasons for it, but I certainly have colleagues who are more skeptical than I am about whether these texts really represent the words of the Buddha. But this brings me now to really my main point, which may be new to many of you, about how we could often judge whether we have the Buddha's words. You will read in texts published in modern Western books published not all that long ago that there is no reference, no direct reference in any Buddhist text to the Brahminical text. This is simply untrue. I and pupils of mine and people I'm associated with have discovered a lot of such references, in particular to the oldest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, but also a few to other Brahminical texts. And after all, as I've already mentioned, the Buddhist texts themselves show Brahmins often coming to talk with the Buddha. It's not surprising, you see, that he would have talked more to Brahmins who were, as it were, the professional intelligentsia of that age, with a lot of differences, of course, from what we now mean by intelligentsia, but still, the professional intelligentsia of that age, he would have talked to them rather more than he would have talked to agricultural labourers who didn't have very much time for that kind of thing. And he often showed what much later came to be known as his skill in means, his upaya kaushalya, by initially accepting what the Brahmin said and said, yes, yes, absolutely, I totally agree with you, and then turning the terms round, I think the best English word for it is he ironized what they said. Well, sometimes he simply twisted it outrageously. An example of outrageous twisting is a very fundamental one in Buddhism. The Brahmin religion was based on performing certain rituals which were specific to the performer, the time, place, occasion, and so on. All these rituals were called deeds, karma, and they were the deeds that really counted. And they were all matters of action. If you did them wrong, you had to perform a penance and then go back and do them again, usually. They were matters of deed, not thought. And the Buddha said, yes, of course, karma is all important. You know, Buddhism is really built on the belief in karma. But by karma, I mean intention. And that's just about like saying by black, I mean white. I mean, it is completely outrageous from the linguistic point of view. So he turned everything round completely. That has been recognized. It's also so obvious that people can't avoid recognizing it, that when he wants to talk of a really holy person, or indeed an enlightened person, a person who has achieved enlightenment in his term, he often calls that person a Brahmin. This particularly often occurs, in fact, in that set of poems that I just referred to called the Attakavagga. He says a true Brahmin or a Brahmin does so-and-so. Well, once we've inserted in English the word true, of course we get the point. Somebody who's a Brahmin by birth is not the real Brahmin, not the real holy man. The true Brahmin is so-and-so. But the Buddha didn't always put in a word equivalent to the true. He just said the Brahmin is somebody who does so-and-so, not somebody who is born of a Brahmin mother and a Brahmin father and has been through the correct rituals in their upbringing. The Brahmin is somebody who does not cling to any views, who is free from greed, hatred, and delusion. That sort of thing, you see. Now, that's quite obvious that he used certain social terms as metaphors. He used also that at the other end of the social scale, the outcast. He said, well, who is a true outcast? It's not somebody who has unclean jobs of cleaning up corpses and dung. It's the outcast is somebody who has lots of vices. That is the real outcast. That's in the Vassala Sutta of the Sutta Nipata. But there are many more allusions to the Brahmin texts which have often escaped notice, and some of them are really very, very important, and I think are going to change our view of what the Buddha taught in some very important ways. And there's been a series of articles and about these things, and some of them are mentioned in my book, How Buddhism Began, and I hope that more will be published in due course. But let me mention perhaps the two most important ones. The two most important ones are these. Firstly, in a sutta called the Tevijja Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya, the Buddha addresses two young Brahmins who come to him in puzzlement about the doctrines of Brahminism. Tevijja means to do with the three knowledges. Now, the Brahmins had, central to Brahmin culture was three knowledges. The word for knowledge is Veda, and Vidya is a perfect synonym of Veda in Sanskrit. Having three knowledges in Pali is te vidya. So we're talking about, it's like if we talk about a Christian as somebody who knows the four Gospels or something. Here we're talking about people who have the three knowledges. The Buddha said that there are, not just in that text, that there are three knowledges which will constitute enlightenment. Those are, some of you will remember, knowledge of your own former births, knowledge of the process of rebirth occurring everywhere in other people, and then knowledge that your own corruptions, your own asavas have been destroyed. These constitute the three knowledges, he says. So you see, again, he takes a piece of Brahminical terminology. This isn't very important in the sense it's not going to change our view of Buddhism. But he takes a piece of Brahminical terminology that there are three knowledges. He uses the very words that Brahmins use for that, for knowledge of that kind. And he says, no, those aren't three texts called the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, and the Yajur Veda. Those are three spiritual accomplishments, of which, of course, the third is the most important. So in this text, in this sutta called the Sutta of the Three Knowledges, where he talks to Brahmins, he continually makes fun, in a gentle but nevertheless rather incisive way, of the pretensions of Brahmin teaching and Brahmins who claim to teach about Brahman, somebody they have never seen and never had any personal contact with. And he says, you want to go and join up with Brahman? That's exactly like somebody who says, I want to marry the beauty queen of this country. And if you say, well, where does she live? What's her name? Give me any personal particulars. They're completely unable to do so. They have no idea where this beauty queen is or who she is or whatever. He says, well, isn't that a ludicrous position to hold? You have no idea where Brahman, the supreme spirit, is or what it is or who it is or anything. And you can't even claim that you know anybody or the son of anybody who has ever had any such contact. And yet you say you want to go and join Brahman. Then he says, I'll teach you what going to join Brahman is really about. And he says that going to join Brahman is really about abolishing all limitations in your thought. And those limitations, so that you attain what are called boundless states of mind, and those he calls are the true dwellings with Brahma. The Pali term is Brahma Vihara. And there are four of them. One is loving kindness, or metta in Pali. The second is compassion, karuna. The third is empathetic joy, mudita. And the fourth is equanimity, upekkha. Now, you probably, most of you know a lot about this, and you may even have read the text in translation. But the Buddha clearly says in the original of that text that if you succeed in this, with any one of these four, you attain liberation of the mind. Liberation of the mind. Well, liberation of the mind, I mean, this is not, the Buddha was not, although he expressed himself wonderfully well, with great elegance and precision, he wasn't writing a logic textbook. And you could say that the word of the mind is redundant. I'm sure I can think of specific German scholars who would say that. But liberation of the mind is redundant in the sense that for Buddhists, of course, it is always, if there is liberation, it must be liberation of the mind. It's never liberation of the nose or of your big toe. It's liberation of the mind. In fact, it's a feature of the style of the early Pali texts that things are often referred to with a double expression. He's a good friend of mine, a dear friend, or something like that. That sort of way of putting things is found everywhere in the early Pali texts. Again, these are oral texts where you have a certain amount of redundancy, repetition built in to make sure that the meaning gets across. And very often, this phrase, liberation of the mind, occurs along with another expression, panya vimutti. Panya, wisdom, understanding. I like the translation understanding, but you often have wisdom, prajna in Sanskrit. So it's liberation of the mind, liberation through understanding. Those two phrases refer to the same thing. In fact, they aren't always both used. When the Buddha preached the first sermon, he said that when he had realized the Four Noble Truths, including the Noble Eightfold Path, he achieved for himself liberation of the mind. And it says at the end of the second sermon, the Anuttalakkhana Sutta, that when he had preached this to the first five disciples, they achieved liberation of the mind. Moreover, I think we all know that not merely in Buddhism, but in Indian religion generally, liberation is liberation. You can't actually grade liberation. Either it really is an all or nothing matter. You're either liberated or not. When I say it's an all or nothing matter, I don't mean, of course, you can't make progress towards it. Of course you can and you should. But either you're liberated or you aren't. It's like the famous housemaid's baby. Are you pregnant just a little? I mean, you can't be just a little pregnant. You can't be just a little liberated. Either you're liberated or you're not. That is clear the Buddhist doctrine, and vimutti is used to mean liberation. However, there's a very curious kink in early Buddhist doctrine, which remains in Theravadin doctrine, and you can read it in Buddhaghosa as Visuddhimagga and so on. And that is this, that although the text says that if you attain these states of love and equanimity and so on, you attain liberation of the mind, in other words, you attain nirvana, this is changed in later doctrine. And it is said, if you attain these, but you don't penetrate intellectually to the realization that everything is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and lacking in self, you will be born in a very high heaven, the heaven of Brahman, but you will not attain enlightenment by that ipso facto. I mean, you have another bite of the cherry, of course, you go on in the next life, but it doesn't get you there. Why did they do this? Well, there's a text in the Majjhima Nikaya where Sariputta, to whom are attributed all the sort of beginnings of systematic logic chopping, he's called the father of the Abhidhamma, of course, actually says, well, there are two kinds of liberation. There's a sort of a grade B and a grade A, and we'll call the grade B Chitta Vimutti, liberation of the mind, and we'll call the grade A liberation by understanding. And one of them is kuppa, that means sort of reversible, and the other is irreversible. This is a kind of reversible liberation of the mind. That's not good Buddhist doctrine in most areas, that you have a reversible liberation of the mind. But obviously this text, attributed to Sariputta, is trying to solve a problem. What has gone wrong? Why the problem? You can answer this in general terms. Firstly, you can say, well, the doctrine has settled down to the idea that to attain nirvana is to extinguish the fires of passion, hatred, and delusion. and extinguishing the fire of delusion is tantamount to understanding that everything is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and lacking in self. It's all cut and dried, we know what it's all about, and any other sort of route is not envisaged as getting the whole way. What has really gone wrong, though, is that the tradition has failed to realize that the Buddha is ironizing the Brahmin doctrine of salvation. The Brahmin doctrine of salvation in the Upanishads is that salvation, that is, realization of the ultimate gnosis, namely that you are ultimately one with the universe, that this gnosis leads you to be reborn with Brahman, which is itself a sort of metaphorical or mythological way of saying that you sort of merge into the supreme spirit of death. This is in the sixth book of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. The Buddha is taking this and is saying, you want to be reborn with Brahman, you want to go to Brahman when you die, I'll tell you how to do it. And then he tells them something which is nothing to do with that at all, really. But he says, you see, that will get you to Brahman. He says, so he's equating getting to Brahman, which he's ironizing, which is not meant to be taken literally at all, he's equating that with liberation of the mind. Now, I haven't heard anybody produce any kind of argument against this interpretation yet, and until somebody does, I shall continue to believe that the Buddha was perhaps a less systematic teacher than has hitherto been thought, and thought that there were several ways, perhaps, of attaining nirvana, one of which was to cultivate infinite kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. Whether all four or just one of those four, I leave open. It's really not very important, perhaps. The last point, which I'm going to make, again, I can only touch on, but it's really very important, is this, that in the Buddhist tradition, there's something they call the central doctrine of Buddhism, as you probably know. And the central doctrine of Buddhism is the chain of dependent origination. And there's something very, very odd indeed about the chain of dependent origination, and that is that in the main sutta, where it is originally expounded in the Digha Nikaya, the Mahanidana Sutta, the sutta begins in a unique way. It begins with Ananda and the Buddha having a conversation. And Ananda says, that thing that you taught about the chain of dependent origination, that's absolutely brilliant, and I understand it. And the Buddha turns around and says, don't say you understand it. It's much too difficult for it. It's much too profound. You can't possibly understand it. Now, the Buddha doesn't normally behave like that. He's a supremely good communicator, and I think he would normally really have regarded it as a failure if he'd preached doctrine and the person he preached it to simply couldn't understand it. If the person says, I can understand it, and he reprimands him for understanding it, what has happened here? What has happened here is that the tradition does not fully understand the doctrine. And there is ample proof for that, because the doctrine is stated just like this, not in five texts, but probably, I haven't counted them, but it probably occurs in about 100 sutras, with all sorts of variants. The commentarial explanations go in different schools are nearly as numerous. Everybody knows what the general principle being taught is, that it's the principle of causation and that one thing leads to another and so on. You probably all know it too. But why exactly it goes from ignorance to volitions, to consciousness, to name and form, to the six sense bases and so on, why exactly it goes in that order, there is no agreement about at all. And hence, there's considerable disagreement. For instance, does this go over one life? Does it go over two lives? Does it go over three lives, the standard Theravadin interpretation? Is it just about the individual? Is it about the cosmos? And so on and so forth. There is no agreement in the Buddhist tradition of why exactly it is formulated like that. And a Polish lady called Joanna Jurewicz has published an article in the Journal of the Pali Text Society 2000. She's a Vedic scholar, and she has shown that why it goes like that is that the Buddha is taking Vedic cosmogony about how the world originates according to Vedic texts, is repeating it and again ironizing it. Ironizing it, because in the Vedic view of things. This is a success story. The world is good, according to the Veda. And this is somehow how it begins, with consciousness arising. And it leads to the world that we know. The Buddha takes the first few links in exactly the same way as the Vedic texts. But then he says, but look, what does all this lead to? Suffering, jara marana, decrepitude and death, suffering, grief, lamentation. And why is that, of course? Because there is no Atman. There is no central core. There is no self at the core of all this. And so we can follow, he's saying to the Brahmins, we can follow and accept your idea of how things evolve, but the evolution is disastrous. And all we want to do is to get out of this mess, to get out of this endless cycle, which you posit correctly from your point of view, and I can accept your formulation of it. But what you haven't understood is that there is no central self to give the whole thing meaning. This is, of course, fairly complicated. There are a lot of texts involved in explaining this and so on, but I think I've correctly explained to you the essence of her discovery. And it does make sense of the particulars of this famous teaching. So that's probably rather more than enough for one evening.